Matt Segundel here. It is true that I only concern myself with poetry when slurring my words. There is a certain natural meter that emerges after so many drinks. A bartender can pour you a double, and you can suitably recite a heroic couplet. You can listen to another man ramble, and there is a certain hymnody in the way he cries and whimpers because he has lost his job, his woman, his mortgage, or perhaps his dog. And certainly there are merry beats that come from one's metronomic exhales into a breathalyzer. But Toby Barlow knows none of this particular type of poetic pain. His book is for the dogs, who, as famous paintings show us, tend to prefer cards to drink and therefore cannot be trusted. Thus, Barlow and his poetry cannot be trusted.
Okay, so I am here with Toby Barlow, who is most recently the author of Sharp Teeth. Toby, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you very much.
Okay, well, I first of all wanted to ask you about the appeal of free verse in relationship to what could be argued as a horror novel or a fantasy novel. Does this mean, I suppose, that did you strive for more kind of literary sensibility with this, or do genre distinctions really matter for you?
Genre distinctions, I don't really, you know, it being my first book, I don't have enough of a body of work to consider myself a genre writer. Mm-hmm. If my next book is a werewolf book, then I will be a werewolf writer. But, you know, with a body of one, it's hard to generalize.
Yeah.
But it did definitely help me justify why I was writing in verse as I wrote it. You know, it being my first novel, I had to sort of talk to myself as I went along, like, I'm not crazy, this is not insane, it's okay that I'm writing all these lines of free verse, it's adding up to something.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I told myself was I was writing about altered beasts. I was writing about, you know, creatures that weren't the usual creatures. And so therefore, using a style of writing that was an altered beast itself made sense.
Yeah, well, maybe we could talk a sort of generalized question and get into something a little bit more specific, but okay. How did the lycanthrope mythology come about? I mean, you draw upon particular books, but there's an emphasis here on biology. For example, there's the moment when one of the lycanthropes does a line of coke, and you have a blade of fur stick out. So there's definitely a concern for physiology, and I'm wondering, was it more of a kind of existential pragmatism, so to speak, of making sure a detail would lodge into this particular legend, or did you draw on particular source texts for this?
No, I sort of walked away from a lot of the mythology that existed. I kind of thought that if these are hidden creatures, then their rules aren't going to be general knowledge, and so you can kind of explore new rules for them. It's actually interesting, Terry Pratchett, who I was only recently reading the series of books that he has with werewolves in them,
yeah.
And I was actually very pleased because he had the same sort of voluntary change that a werewolf could go through, and it was the only time I'd encountered that. Everybody else seemed to follow the rules of the moon,
huh,
and the lunar cycles. So,
did you want to deviate from what was set down in the werewolf canon, essentially?
I didn't want to be hung up by it. It seemed to me to be... I couldn't actually ever understand the philosophy behind that those rules. I think that, you know, what werewolf mythology is really about is, you know, coming to terms with our own animal nature, and why that animal nature would only exhibit itself, you know, once a month, didn't really make any... I just couldn't kind of parse it out in my own mind to make sense of it. So it seemed more interesting, the idea that, boy, sometimes you feel like being a human being and sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, what would make those decisions happen when they did, and what would make people choose at one point of time to be a dog and one point of time to be a human being.
I'll get off genre taxonomies very soon, but I'll just ask you one question along these lines. I read Brian Francis Slattery's Spaceman Blues, which also had this kind of giddy or exuberant quality. It's almost as if your book and Spaceman Blues fall into some hyper-giddy version of the new weird. I'm wondering if the innovators of the new weird were in your mind as you were writing this particular book, or where this particular exuberance come from? Did it come from the free verse, or did it come from a kind of concentration on these pragmatic elements, as I was sort of suggesting before, with the blade of fur popping up?
Right. I mean, I think that one thing I wanted to do, once I'd sort of set my rules, was find as much play in them as I could, and because I think that not only is more entertaining for the reader, but it also just dimensionalizes it. You really do begin to understand the biology of the creatures that you're playing with. I don't know if I could say that the any particular contemporary genre influenced me. I was sort of influenced by a lot of more classical styles. I mean, I think probably the most modern reference was, well, two of them, Rachel Carson's Autobiography of Red, which was a really interesting way to play with poetry and play with verse in a sort of messed up way. The Bartholomew's Snow White, which I thought was just an incredibly fun way to turn things upside down. And White Jazz by James Ellroy, which probably stylistically is the closest thing that I've encountered to what I tried to do. And I tried to do something very different than what I think he was doing with it. But I remember reading it and really enjoying the almost deliciously electric pace of it, and the idea that, wow, you can really go a lot faster than I think literature lets itself go a lot of times.
So speed was very much a paramount concern for you. Did the free verse kind of help you accelerate things along in terms of narrative? And also maybe we can talk about how the narrative was concocted. It's a five book structure, almost Greek-like, I suppose.
Yeah, there were a lot of sort of playful nods to Homer. You know, the first line being an homage, and then the structure itself. But also the structure itself was, you know, breaking up what was a very long, rambly story.
Yeah.
And so just kind of building places for an arc to kind of have a hit seemed to make sense. I don't know if that answered your question.
Well, it sort of gets there. Right. It's interesting you mentioned Ellroy, because you also have, you basically say to the reader, pay attention throughout the course of the book. Is this kind of a call for the reader to kind of mine underneath of what's going on here? Or maybe you can talk about the various layers in which this particular book works. I mean, for example, there's a number of things we can talk about, but I think since we're talking about culture, maybe we can talk about the pop cultural references. You have a cop named Peabody, and I was thinking, oh, hey, where's his Wayback Machine? Okay. You have a one-armed man, which reminiscent of The Fugitive, right. A cop of a Kojak lollipop. The list goes on and on. There's all sorts of pop culture. I mean, was this sort of the pay attention that we're talking about?
A little bit. I mean, there was something very kitchen sinkish about the book. I knew that I had these characters that I really liked and I wanted to play with, and I wanted to see where they went. But I also wanted to create something that honestly entertained me, because I was writing something whose marketability at the time seemed very limited.
Yeah.
So if I was going to spend the time and effort, I was going to sort of pack it with as much as I could. So not only the references that you mentioned, but I mean, there are all sorts of hidden things that I've even forgotten about that I'll read and I'll be like, oh yeah, I did. You know, there's references to, I tried to put as many dog book references as possible in there. So there are nods to Jack London and to the 101 Dalmatians, and I mean, just, you know, here and there talked about the place, just sort of, you know, Easter eggs.
Well,
for myself,
there's also Nobody But Him is playing the white collar. There's you have someone walking to their end with Kendall Resignation, and I wanted to ask you about these particular puns, because they strike me as having some additional purpose to remind the reader that, hey, we are in a dog eat dog world, so to speak. These are very purposeful puns. Did you set any particular criteria on when you decided to go ahead and amp up the wordplay like this, that a pun had to be purposeful in some sense?
I really just wanted the reader never to forget that this was supposed to be an enjoyable experience. And I also wanted, as much as possible, those lines to be crossed just as the characters were changing their physiology. I wanted the reader to kind of change their psychology as they read it, from, you know, engrossment to entertainment to bemusement. Going back to something you were saying earlier, I mean, the free verse did allow me sort of to have a much more driven pace. And to, you know, I would say cut corners in storytelling. You can move around a lot faster when you're dealing with a slightly stranger style of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And just so long as, you know, when you take a sharp turn, you don't sort of send the reader over the deep end.
This relationship between the physiological and the psychological, I mean, this also leads me into another tangent involving the many water metaphors in reference to love throughout, but maybe first we can talk about this notion of how the free verse, often cutting off a particular simile or a particular direction of description to the reader with a line break. The line breaks in this book seem to cut off or suggest a dichotomy that is veering off into two. And I'm wondering what attention you placed on the specific line break. Was there a particular science or a particular...
It wasn't a science as much as it was an ear, and sort of like it was a double ear. It was, I knew I wasn't writing poetry, so I was not looking at it in that style or strict formal style. But I did want... I did create breaks most of the time. There are a lot of line breaks in it, but most of the time I was creating breaks when I wanted the ear to catch twice. So the phrase had its own meaning, and I wanted to break up that phrase and sort of break the way that you were going to hear it or see it, so that there would be a kind of constant tumbling over process as you went through the book. Because, I think that kind of added a lot of drive to the piece. Even lines that sort of felt cliche, if you break them in the right way, they're suddenly not cliche anymore. They're suddenly a little... There's just a bump in the road where you didn't expect it. And I just wanted to keep people both kind of guessing and thinking and moving through it.
It seems to me that love and water seem to push the poetic prosody in this. You have, for example, a body that's described with a sea of scars and the like. And I'm wondering what it was about this water and love metaphor that caused you to tip yourself into this more extreme verse, as opposed to kind of a more rhythmic verse that flows throughout the remainder of the book. And it is a tangential question. I have to ask you if there were perhaps some abandoned ad slogans that somehow found its way into the book.
Oh, that's funny. No, there was no, there wasn't any advertising or product placement. I mean, the writing of the book itself was sort of an antidote to a day-to-day life lived, in advertising.
But there is UPS in there.
Oh yeah, there are some brands wandering around, but yeah, None of them paid to be there.
Yeah.
I think that the relationship from water to land in this book, and to the and the way that water reflected the emotion of the characters was, it was definitely purposeful. I'm a very big fan of Mark Reisner's book called Cadillac Desert, mm-hmm. which is a nonfiction book about the mutilation of the Western landscape to feed Los Angeles. It's a fantastic book, and Los Angeles itself has always seemed to me to be sort of a, almost phantasmagoric fantasy in and of itself, that it's a desert.
Yeah.
And, I think that a lot of the characters that I was playing with were desert characters. They were very dry, and they were very, cracked and broken. Yeah. And I think that love is sort of the sustenance that makes them human, that softens them and brings them to life. So I was sort of playing around with that. I can't recall playing around with the meter of the language when I was talking about water, but I know that it was a very important part of what I was trying to say.
Yeah. The thing I want to talk about also is the Los Angeles setting. There are a couple of Chandler-esque sort of descriptions, such as the publicity director, who's described as having a composure that carries the warmth of Tiffany Crystal and the instincts of a hitman, which is... basically Chandler popped into my mind with this. I'm wondering if Chandler was one of the influences possibly on the description, whether that affected why you set this book in Los Angeles, or maybe you can discuss how LA kind of popped into your mind, or just did it seem to be by way of this desert landscape and by way of being the center of Hollywood and a good advertising center that this made sense for the purpose of the book?
It made sense for the book for a few reasons. I think that pulp, from Ross McDonald to Chandler to any number of people, to the script of Double Indemnity, I mean, pulp has always thrived in Los Angeles. It's a city with it's sort of all kind of exposed there on the sun-baked plain, in a way. And so I think that it felt very fertile. It felt like a place where you could imagine dogs sort of rambling loose in the streets and no one really doing something about it. If it was in New York, people would go insane if they saw a pack of dogs. And actually, one of the things that did inspire it was I was driving in East LA once, and I was driving under an underpass, and we looked over and we did see a pack of dogs that was about 60 dogs deep, just wandering through the middle of inner city Los Angeles, and it was a vision. I mean, I would have to say that, one of the seeds of the novel was planted there and then. But it's a fun town to play with. The way that, you know, you have a few large cultures up against each other, and the way that class plays itself out in that city seems very, very interesting.
Well, going back to the Chandler-esque metaphors, I mean, did this pulp influence kind of create these sorts of deviations again? I mean, again, we were talking about the deviations that come with the love and the water, but right. they also often come when you introduce even a minor character along with the description that I just read you.
Right. There's no doubt there's enormous amounts of pulp fiction in this book. I mean, and you know, one of the ways that we, you know, have been talking about it is it's a pulp novel that's been, you know, a hard-boiled detective novel that's been boiled until all the extra words are gone. So there's, you know, it's definitely a playful homage to that. I mean, one of my favorite books is Gun with Occasional Music,
yes.
Which, you know, also played with the genre in sort of a meta-weird kind of way. So, I mean, I think that the one thing about pulp fiction is that it does get sort of poetically playful in the way that it sums up characters and toys with them and sort of, you know, shows them, I don't know, almost in haiku form. I would have to say that was a pretty serious influence.
Gotcha. Well, in terms of pulp fiction, if you viewed this work as pulp fiction, did this essentially liberate you? You had nothing to prove necessarily. You could pretty much go wherever you wanted to go, like Elroy?
I think that not nailing myself to a genre and not nailing myself to the idea that this was serious fiction and not nailing myself to the idea that this was frivolous fiction. I mean, deciding that really it was about the characters and the places they went and the things they did and taking the thoughts as deep or as wide as I wanted to. I think that if I had been aiming for a certain specific genre, I would have been letting that genre write the rules instead of letting the characters write the rules.
Yeah.
And so it was much more fun to, you know, let the actors be their own motivators.
Well, there's not just actors. There's also odd statistics and facts that are interspersed throughout the book. For example, the one that really comes to mind is that 38% of the homeless population of the nation lives in Los Angeles. Was this something you invented, or did you actually find this set somewhere else from some other pamphlet? I have to ask you about that.
I got that from a place I like to call the interweb. I don't really know if it's statistically valid or not, but it was something that was sort of out there. The dog, you know, the fact that the dog population of Los Angeles is larger than the human population of Atlanta is a fascinating fact that I got out of it. There was a book about the wilderness of Los Angeles that's actually a really fascinating book. And that's another interesting thing about that city is that you've got these hills and these valleys and these waterways that kind of go through it that everybody works around, but nobody actually admits that they're actually, you know, intermingling with the wilderness more than they think they are.
Yeah, well, in the Santa Ana winds, of course.
Yeah, well, when they start blowing, strange things happen, you know.
The marketing campaign in this book, there are a couple of slogans that are communicated through the television, and I wanted to ask you about this. If you were mining the interweb for some of your inspiration for this, I'm wondering if there were particular text or sentences that sort of seemed right to throw into this thing. It's almost like what you're describing here is kind of like sort of a, you know, mashup or a hip-hop sampling of some sort.
A little bit. I mean, I think the book itself is an enormous mashup between, you know, epic poetry and, you know, Raymond Chandler-esque books and, you know, gothic novels. So, I mean, there was some definite fun mashing up to be had.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you about one curious tick throughout the book, and that is a verb reflecting the noun. You have a guy on the phone suggesting interested in your interest. You have contemplates the contemplation. And there's numerous examples of this throughout the book. It's almost as if you're suggesting that the dog world is beholden to literalisms like this, and I wanted to ask how this came about.
Well, I definitely tried to sort of play with the language as much as I could. The contemplates the contemplation is actually from Aristotle when he talks about the prime mover.
Yeah. So that came from Aristotle, then the prime mover and the coyote.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a bit of a actual, you know, if you read the metaphysics, Aristotle writes about, he basically logics his way to the prime mover who, you know, creates all and creates all by contemplating its own contemplation, as I recall it. But what seemed interesting to me there was this idea of the, you know, Gödel's incompleteness theorem, and there would have to be something left over, and that would be Coyote. And so if you look at any mythology, there's usually, you know, whether it's God and Satan, or whether it's, you know, Loki, or whether it's Hermes, you always have this sort of extra mischief god who kind of just causes trouble.
So, but Aristotle wasn't referring to the coyote specifically, so this is a definite mashup again here.
Yeah, no, I just added a sidekick to Aristotle's god. You know, I thought he probably needed one.
Was the Yukon Way taken from some philosopher of some sort?
No, that was just, you know, I figured if these guys were running around with their... In their tribalism, they would invent their own myths and their own ways and their own patterns. And
yeah.
So I wanted to explore the different, you know, ways that different tribes could organize themselves. So the one tribe, Lark's Pack, does sort of practice this, you know, abstinence, and in that abstinence, sort of creates a tension that they can stay true to, It's their discipline, sort of the, you know, DC punk rock straight edge rules.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, Anthony at one point claims, after pinning down a lycanthrope, he says that he happens to know martial arts. And this struck me as quite amusing because it was almost a nod to that convenient explanation after the fact in a genre book or even a film, right, where the hero is possessed of some kind of ability that we didn't know before. And I wanted to ask you about how this book ties into the so-called heroic quest trope that you often find in every one of these kinds of books, in a wide variety, in Pulp Fiction in particular, you know?
That's interesting. There is an earlier, a small earlier reference to the fact that he's a black belt in karate, and that's when Callie takes him to visit the other dog catcher's house. The reason he brings him along is that he knows karate. But no, it's not. It's certainly not an emphasis in his character. I think that I just wanted him to be a strong person, and that was a shorthand way to symbolize strength.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to, in the mashup sense, you know, I'm a huge sort of Jackie Chan, Bruce Lee fan, and I wanted to kind of have a nod to that as well. So, you know, where it would suit the character and where it seemed right for the character, I wanted to keep dimensionalizing these characters as much as possible, even if it wasn't necessary to the plot, because I think that, you know, we want the people we encounter in our lives to be rounded, you know?
Well, in terms of Lark hiding out with Bonnie, this was very interesting to me because there's also very much a pragmatic sense of how the dogs operate. The dog is essentially going to Bonnie, and Bonnie is confessing all these typical things that a dog owner is likely to say to her dog. You know, it's almost as if these very basic behavioral moments kind of turn the free verse or the pulp thing into something that I guess is more accessible or more... Maybe you could talk about how these behavioral observations and imbuing the dog universe with things that all of us know, how this kind of helps to sort of make something that is a quirky book a little bit more accessible to the reader, a little bit more
approachable.
Approachable, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's funny because people will say, gosh, this free verse, it looks so strange, I'm not really sure I want to read a free verse book. But then you would find the same people sort of reading along with the lyrics on the back of an LP, and that's free verse or verse. And you know, you'll find people reading pages upon pages of dialogue, which is, if you look at the way dialogue's parsed out on a page, it's verse. And so, you know, you do have a lot of... We're much more flexible in the way we approach reading, especially in these days where we're reading text messages and, you know, quickly written emails and blogs. I mean, we're reading text in a very different way than we ever have before. I think that in this particular case, I was trying to use the text. Again, this is, you know, this is a different creature's point of view. This creature has a different rhythm to the way that they see the world.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, but it's got to be approachable. It's got to be sort of fun to read. I think literature has enough problems these days without making itself too obscure, too hard. So the grounding, I mean, the Bonnie adventure was, you know, very fun to write because I don't think that tales about, you know, altered states and altered creatures go to the mundane. They don't have the adventures in the mundane like I think the Bonnie adventure is for Lark. He's purposefully being ordinary. And that for him is a very strange experience. That's, you know, almost freaking him out.
Particularly since he's being groomed and essentially taken care of as well. And here's a guy who can... In fact, while we're on the subject, I think it's really funny that Lark is a lawyer. And in fact, there are a lot of lawyers throughout this book. Was there a specific sort of... do you have many dealings with lawyers or what happened here?
I mean, no, I love lawyers. I think that there was... The interesting thing about the law is that it allows you to go to a lot of different strata of civilization, you know? I mean, somebody in a trailer park has a lawyer, and Rupert Murdoch has a lawyer. So they could do a lot of different things. And, you know, frankly, there's a mindset of a lawyer as being a bit mercenary and being, I don't know, capable of feral behavior at times that I think was fun to play with.
The one, in speaking of feral behavior, the one consistent image that we see throughout this are the three dogs in the cage who are eating the carne asada tacos. And initially, we see them as empathetic, and then their memory gradually is lost throughout the course of the book. And was this kind of a way to kind of sort of signal to the reader, hey, what you're seeing is this complete decline into just utter primary, rudimentary states of being?
Yeah, I mean, those three dogs, I think, symbolized a lot. They symbolize the passage of time. They sort of, you know, I set my storytelling watch to them. They also, you know, they symbolize the transitory nature of every adventure. You know, all this stuff happens, and there's all this bloodletting and love, and, you know, at the end of it, you know, life goes on, and, you know, these adventures fade.
Now, the bridge tournament in this, was this a nod to C.M. Coolidge, or what was the deal there?
No, I play bridge, and I think the bridge is one of the most underappreciated pastimes on the planet. I thought that it would be fun to see if one could tell the story of a bridge tournament to people who didn't play bridge. In a way that would make it dramatic.
It's because I kept thinking the bridge tournament was almost a bridge to a civilized plane to some degree, and that might have been one of the motivating factors for choosing that particular game, but I guess...
That's funny you should say that. I didn't think about it that literally, but I did think about the fact that it's a different tribe. It's an invisible tribe. You know, you see this little corner of the newspaper with a bridge column in it, and for 99.9% of the population, that's meaningless. But other people, it's like they dig into that. So that there were lots of different strata and lots of different tribes that we were touching upon. They're basically packs.
I wanted to also ask you about the idea of these dogs as misunderstood misfits. It reminded me very much of Alfred Brester's story, Hobson's Choice. And I wanted to ask you if that was possibly on your mind, or if you went back to any particular literary antecedent, or whether it just seemed like the instinctive kind of thing to do for a novel that's very much about instinct.
It was very much the latter. I mean, I think that what I was trying to do was explore again, going back to Aristotle and the idea that man is a political animal. So what happens to the animals who are sort of cast out, and can they be collected and used to a certain end? I mean, I think that if you look at a lot of mass movements in history, you know, the scream of the rabble of the crowd is being incited by something very different than what they're actually screaming for.
Yeah.
And a lot of that's a desire for oneness or a desire for community. And so I think that we live in a society that can be very isolating and can push people out. And what I wanted to do is look at what happens when those people get together in ordinary or in interesting and not so ordinary ways.
Anthony's girlfriend is deliberately unnamed, and I wanted to ask you why that was. Is this really sort of to represent the kind of identity crisis that many of the lycanthropes are having, as well as Anthony, too? Was this a kind of mere lack of names sort of situation?
No, I think that, to a great degree, just went back to the idea of it being an homage to many archetypes of storytelling, and that she was, you know, the heroine of the tale, and in being the heroine, she was sort of very much an every woman character, and the things that she struggles with, which are, you know, trying to get overcome pain in her past, and trying to actually love the person she's with, and in a true and consistent manner, are, I think, universal struggles. Yeah. So I was just very interested in her being this you know, nod to all the sort of dark women of, you know, film noir history, from, you know, Laura to you know, the girls in Mulholland Drive.
I'm wondering, though, if you're dwelling so much on a universal motif going throughout, is there a risk of this taking away from the distinctness of the free verse, or the, you know, or even, like, for example, we were talking earlier about Anthony's convenient black belt.
Right.
I mean, I'm wondering if this sort of takes away, or if you need to have some of these things in there as guidance for the reader, that you need to have a kind of rooted structure with themes that everybody can recognize.
Well, I mean, it's a very Joseph Campbell-y question. I think that you do need both. I think that you need surprises, and I think you need predictability. I think you need a story arc where people feel like they understand where you're going, and then I think you need to take them to new places. You can't sort of blow people's mind every single page, or else they'll just, you know, collapse exhausted. I think that you have to promise them something that they know, and then reveal something that they don't.
Given that there are a lot of real heavy descriptions of things, I'm wondering if there were early drafts in which you did, in fact, have pages upon pages of rich metaphors or things like that.
Yeah, I mean, this was a pretty... This was a document that we worked with a long time, but, I think that what we tried to do was, you know, when I was working with my editor, Jennifer Barth, it was, you know, sort of make sure that we didn't leave sort of big, fat, strange parts into it that, you know, were like marshland. You know, we wanted to keep the drive. We wanted to keep the momentum.
What would be an example of this marshland that you had to
work
out?
Oh, I had, you know, I suddenly went back centuries to, you know, massive dogfights that happened over fallen packs of buffalo. I mean, it was just, you know, it was all pretty strange and rambly. And, you know, I think that what when I was working with Jennifer on it, what she, I think, rightfully said was, you know, you don't want to lose the drive in a story.
Yeah, but there's also something very Homeric about this, such a flashback like that. You know, I mean.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. I was again trying to continually contextualize everything that I wrote about. So it's, you know, this has all happened before. This is all entirely new. Are the two themes of the book.
Did you find yourself resisting flashbacks? Because it is very much set in the present, with only the memory through... the memory is conveyed largely through a sentence that describes how a person got to that particular... in the present, as we are reading.
Right.
And I'm wondering if this was one of those things that represented, say, a mammoth flashback to the buffalo that was basically had to be confined to a couple of sentences over the editing process.
Yeah. There wasn't a lot of that, but there was... this idea that this is a contemporary tale of contemporary people who are very strange and fucked up, and, you know, and they, you know, it's a love story, and the wandering away from that too much, you would sort of forget that larger, greater theme, which is sort of, you know, how do we live with secrets and how do we live with each other?
Got you. Well, Toby, I know you have to get going, but thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
It was quite fun.
Okay.
Your clothes, and when we're lovers and vows, fresh air perfume.